is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Welcome to Gnosecast, the Gnostic podcast, with the Reverend Troy Pierce, where questions make heretics. Views expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker.
Ring the bell, let still ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Okay, let's begin with the sliding slide. Begin with a brief overview of what we've covered last week. What we've been trying to do in this series is approach the Da Vinci Code and its phenomenon through the lens and filter stories. The stories give us the frameworks in which we understand things and really our way of encapsulating and passing on experience. Last week, looked at the different transformations a story can go through, that it can come from an experience, go to retelling, writing, to reenactment, to ritual, and then to a formalization process where it's taken and made something that no longer touches back to that initial experience. Everything else along the way, think of as being a means of conveying that initial experience and touching back to that initial experience, where the story came from, where that meaning came from. In the case of sacred stories, that's a deep meaning. So when we touch back to that, we're touching back to something transformative, something that changes us. What is uniform in all sacred stories is that they include an experience, a transformation that cannot be directly conveyed in the story. It's not a simple matter of a description. The entirety of the story up to that point has been a preparation for that transformation, for that something, that experience, the transformative thing. And so, if we look at a story, particularly a sacred story, we're not just looking at an end result or a summary. We don't just want the formalization of it, because that no longer carries that experience, no longer gives us any avenue back into the story, into that process, to get in some way that transformative element, the transformative part near the end of the story. In looking at this particular story, in it we have a hieros gamos, a sacred union, coming together of two opposites to create something new, to have some new creative force from that. The way in which we go through a process of transformation isn't to just clip to the end. There isn't a shortcut to the end of the story from the beginning. The image we had before, you can't go across the middle of the circle. You always have to go around the circle. You have to go through a process to get there. And this explains one way of looking at that process, that there are many things that are undifferentiated, unexamined, that we do not turn our conscious attention to, and we do not understand in a deep way. They're just part of life, a part of us, part of the world. But to do anything with anything, you have to take it through a process of understanding and of consciousness, a process of analysis. You have to see what you have. It's generally described as a process of separating out the various elements. Take that undifferentiated mass, spread things out, see what you have, and then you can go through a process where you recombine it into a new form, into something that transcends the old form, to mirror that transformative function that happens in sacred stories, that sacred stories really are about. We look at these stories. What we're looking at really is how we relate story. Sacred story or stories, the heart of Christianity. And this is one of those very big, murky areas. Because even if you aren't a believer or aren't involved directly, you really aren't completely uninvolved, dispassionate observer. It's part of the culture. It's part of the politics. It's a part of who we are. And so the story of Christ becomes something of a Rorschach test. We see in it what we're looking for. The traditional ways of connecting to the story of Christ are through the organization of the church, viewed as really conveying authoritative teachings and also a sacramental authority. There's a written scriptures, these are viewed as history. They're viewed in a particular way. There are the ritual and sacramental functions, but over time they become more and more formalized so that there are specific rules, numbers of times one must attend, certain days of the year one must attend, and so forth. And that individual experience gets poured out of it. Now, the way in which the Da Vinci Code and some other modern authors have seemed to short-circuit this huge conglomeration of stuff we've been saddled with through the centuries is to look at it in a different way. One of those is through this bloodline biology. Another way is to look at this original pair, Mary Magdalene, Christ, and turn them topsy-turvy, turn them upside down, and make Mary Magdalene the important one, and Christ the unimportant one. None of these solutions are really all that satisfactory, as they really seem to be echoes of previous solutions that have been tried. The biology, genetics, really seems to link to the ancient notion of relics, that one has something physical one can touch, hold on to, and that that connects one to the story, the history of the story. There are physical remains from these people and the things that they did and these stories in this book. And having a bloodline really is just having another sort of relic. But a relic isn't just a physical object. It's an object that has a particular meaning to the individual. And in the book, we really see this quest for the Grail end up being about coming to a relic, kneeling at the bones of Mary Magdalene.
You said that I just saw the Da Vinci Code. I didn't get the story Dan Brown told. I didn't get that as making Jesus unimportant. I would say that it made him more like the yin yang you had on two slides back. You know, Jesus and Mary Magdalene are equal importance and are more of a union. Do you get the idea that that made Jesus less important?
Well, in the book, more so than in the movie, he talks about Jesus not being divine and really being made divine by a political act. And that's what I was referring to, is sort of this...
The Council of Nicaea, that didn't happen.
Yeah, reducing of... The Council of Nicaea happened, but that wasn't decided there. The underlying stories, there's truth to, but the facts he points out are inaccurate. That is taking this elevated God-man image and reducing it to a man image, and then bring in Mary Magdalene. So it is the changing of that traditional role wherein she is just, you know, at the feet of
Jesus. Which role can seem much more, it's easier to believe in that secular human being, those two human beings,
you know. Well, that's the appeal of the story today.
I mean, the ridiculous story is a lot harder. I'm a born-again Catholic Christian pagan, and started out with Catholicism. I've been trying to believe in Jesus my whole life. People that claim to hear Jesus in their prayers in their head, I can't buy it because I've tried my whole life. I think it's bunk. People try to relate to that God center of the brain, but Jesus is just alright with me as a human being.
Well, this is the topic tonight. Yep, exactly. And that's a lot of what we're going to be getting to tonight. So you're at the right place, I think. So yeah, the beliefs and so forth can really become a barrier. And essentially, what happened in the traditional view is that those things became a barrier an intermediary between you and the story. In this alternative view, they aren't so much barriers as facilitators. So you have all these things are experiences or ways of sort of encapsulating understanding or conveying things and bringing things forward. So you have symbols instead of relics. Symbol is open. Symbol can be interpreted many different ways, and there's no one way you can reduce a symbol to, because that would mean it wasn't really a symbol to begin with. It was a code or a sign or something else. Whereas symbols really have a richness that can only exist in the individual perceiving them, in the experience of the individual perceiving them. It is a relationship. The same if you view church or community, Buddhism, this is the Sangha. This is one of the fourfold path. As the community of fellow seekers and the tradition that will aid you in getting to your goal spiritually. And also in this alternative tradition, you can see the text not as history, not as objective facts, not as what would happen if somebody was there with the news crew filming these things, but as stories that enframe, encapsulate, and give a particular meaning that the person telling the story has. In the Gnostic tradition, there's talk of there being enormous fictions, these new stories being generated and created. Stories were retold in different ways, turned upside down and topsy-turvy. This alternate view, ritual isn't an objective act. It isn't something that you must do point A to point B, you know, to get to the salvation game at the end, you know, the game of life or something. You participate in ritual for its transformative power, because it touches you back into the story, and through that into the experience at the core of the story, that transformative, ineffable experience. And final thing is visionary experiences. And we're going to look at that in some more detail. But in the alternative shadow side of Christianity, visionary experiences play a fundamental role. And really looking at texts and scriptures with this in mind can give you a fundamentally different understanding of these things. I tend to start out and just get going and then forget to stop and tell people to interrupt me, so interrupt me. And since the was left behind, split off, basically in the Jungian sense, because in the formation of proto-orthodoxy there was the rejection of Gnostic groups, and that really went into the identity of Christianity. But, of course, you can't get rid of it because this is human religious experience. You can't decide what that's going to be ahead of time and have everybody follow in the line. So it has always surfaced, sprung up, been this bubbling spring that will occur in Christianity and every other religious tradition because it comes from human experience. So it is this shadow in that, in the sense of, it's the shadow of the Orthodox, I guess, would be a better way to say it. So we come to this character, this figure of Mary Magdalene, and how much we know about her from different stories. Well, we know very little about her from the canonical stories. In the canonical stories, she apparently was cured from a very serious illness. We don't really know much. It's just reported that she was healed, exorcised of 7 demons. 7 is usually considered to be the number of completion, so it's considered to be very serious possession. But possession in those days wasn't usually so much a character disorder as physical illness, though it could have been either one. So she's reported as having been cured of 7 demons. We also have her reported as being one of 3 women financially support Jesus' ministry and the disciples, wandering around, itinerant preachers, a bunch of hippies out on the countryside. You need to eat, you need some things, it's good to have friends with cash. And the most important thing we have from her in the canonical accounts is that she is the one who announces the resurrection. This isn't in all of them, There's very few things that are in all of the canonical accounts that agree. She is present in, by name, at least two, possibly three, if I remember at the moment. And she is also present in non-canonical sources as being the one who announces the resurrection. So in the Gospel of Peter, I think it is, and a few other sources, she is given that role. So from this very sketchy material, we have our sort of the popular press of the medieval period that came to this day, which was to associate Mary Magdalene with the woman with the alabaster jar, the penitent woman. The text actually doesn't name her, nor does it say what law she was a transgressor of. It could have been any simple Jewish religious custom law. Wouldn't indicate sexual transgression from the text. However, this character becomes incorporated with Mary Magdalene, and we know that this happens, at least as far as we know, for the first time in a sermon by Pope Gregory the Great in the 10th century. And there are many other medieval accounts that make Mary Magdalene into a repentant prostitute. The golden legend and a whole tradition of religious art up through the Renaissance into the Victorian period that has basically, we think of a soft core Mary Magdalene's. You know, she was so overcome with grief afterwards that she couldn't wear any clothes and had to be painted that way. And this is one of those elements that really extends up through this modern age till fairly recently. And Magdalene ends up becoming a euphemism for a fallen woman or a wayward girl. There were the Magdalenes in Ireland where young unwed mothers or just women suspected of being too promiscuous would be sent and basically put into a penitent role, work in laundries for no pay. And so this story of Magdalene really becomes this very odd story. It's mixed in with temptation, with Eve, with sexual transgression, and comes down to us in a few forms, popular forms of, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar and the Last Temptation of Christ and so forth, where this form of Mary Magdalene as this repentant prostitute and also as the woman, the adulteress who was going to be stoned, it's conjoined into one person and becomes this literary character that's different from the one that occurred in the ancient texts. Well, to counteract that, we have a tendency to see these two coming together as man and wife, because it still keeps this kind of sexual transgression or sexual energy or association, but brings it into a more normal understanding, a socially accepted form of marriage, and therefore gives us a bloodline and so forth. And this really seems to be entirely modern. It doesn't seem to be a whole lot of any indication of this prior to 19th century. Now what we have, in some ways, are the sort of two traditional roles played out here for women. You have the wife, mother, or, you know, the harlot. And both of these seem to be stock stories, right? Stereotypical stories pulled out of the back shelf and just applied to these characters. In the Gnostic text, there's actually a very different take. Mary Magdalene is not seen as being a wife. She's not seen as being a harlot or as being unimportant. She's seen as being one of the foremost, if not the foremost, disciple of Christ. One of the few who truly understood what his message was. And we can see that this, in a way, ties into this annunciation, her announcing the resurrection, that this role she plays is actually a very rich one. And if we uncover and clear away these medieval stories and these modern stories, there is another tell that doesn't discount those stories, doesn't reinforce those stories, but it seems to me to be the deeper story, the truer story, the one that makes Mary Magdalene who she really was.
Okay, so the Bible that I'm related to, I guess it'd be the modern Bible, speaks of the disciple that Jesus loved.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes more sense that would be Mary than, you know, some kind of strange, try to put God in this abstract, loving a man strictly on this soul level, as opposed to, you know, the one he kissed, the one he loved. I like what you're saying, that Mary was a disciple.
Actually, one of the theories about that, the beloved disciple, that I like, is that it's actually not referring to a historical character, but it is, in a way, the reader. And that, to me, opens up that whole text in a whole different way, that you're invited, essentially, to enter into the Gospel of John, be the beloved disciple, participate in the experience of the story in that deep sense. There are those who've made, and there's, you know, you do have to make a few connections that aren't there to make an argument that the beloved disciple is Mary Magdalene. But there does seem to be some reason to think that as well. But that love is, of course, the divine love. Love of God, man, and God, divine love between humans.
Is there a way that you can tell these men who you've heard throughout the centuries? And why is there a divination of Mary and a scourging or sort of cycle thing? Do you account for the authors of masculine Mary? Try these two.
That seems to be that the stories before and the stories that people already had were imposed on these Christian stories. And that has been done across the board, really. If you look at the stories that the Gospels, even the canonical Gospels, evoke and echo and really just almost copy, they do so in a way that's very odd. Like the Son of God, the virgin birth, was a common theme because that was how you got to be a demigod. But a demigod was always this hero. Right? Usually son of a king or somebody important or a good warrior or something. But in this story, Son of God is the son of a carpenter's, you know, stepson or whatever, and just wanders around preaching and then gets executed. So it really goes against type. It goes against type in every single one of these stories that it evokes. And so if we look at what has happened since then, I mean, really, I think that going against type is one that explains the popularity of these stories in the ancient world. It wasn't that people weren't familiar with what was being referenced. They were. It's just that it's very refreshing, very interesting, and it really gets your, grabs your attention when somebody does something different with it. Somebody uses a story in a new way to get to a different transformation. And so the story of Mary Magdalene really seems to be this somewhat stark narrative we get from the canonical Gospels, and then people just pull out their other stories of what is a woman? Well, wife or harlot, right? I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of other options in the ancient world. It could be an elderly widow or something, but these things were then imposed upon these very few references. And I don't think it really comes from any particular one individual. It's just that those cultural stories are what people knew. That's how people thought. The ancient world wasn't really a wonderful place to be for if you were a woman or even if you were a man, really, but particularly if you were a woman.
Yeah, go ahead.
It could be, yeah. Yeah, it's, what I'm going to get at is doesn't negate those two, but I think it deepens.
I wasn't aware that there was an idea that Mary Magdalene was a financier of Christ.
His ministry? Yeah, it's only mentioned, I think, in the
book. However, it ties in a lot to she is descendant of Merovingian kings from the south of France, and she would have a lot of money at her disposal.
Well, that's saying that she would have a lot of money at her disposal so she could then travel and do other things. But it's also one of the good arguments against her being married is her having money at her disposal. She's mentioned with three women. She's one of the three. Now, there's Salome, who also appears in the Gnostic texts much more frequently. And I can't remember the third one. She's a wife of an official of Herod's court. So there were at least these three women who had some means, who contributed to the ministry. But again, that tends to indicate that they were married wealthily. They might have been wealthy widows. Something to have access to the funds, you know. So it's also a bit of an argument against. There are arguments both ways. So this is the canonical structure, and you'll see why I'm pointing this out in a minute. And in it, we have this teaching phase, Jesus' ministry, the crucifixion, and then we have the sad story. The original Gospel of Mark basically ends before the appearance of any resurrection, but in the versions that we have now, and the ones in which it is Mary Magdalene named, and the other one it is just the women, there is an appearance of seeing a figure who isn't at first recognized as Jesus. This is somewhat odd. This has been explained as being, you know, she couldn't see clearly through her weeping tears or whatever, but it's a bit odd. She sees this figure, interacts. The interaction is different in all of the different accounts. She then, most of the accounts, is sent to go inform the disciples in some way, and she does. And this earns her, in later on, the medieval period, the title Apostola Apostolorum, which is the apostle to the apostles. Apostle is one who was sent forth. And she is the first one sent forth to go tell the other disciples, who then are sent forth. She becomes the first apostle. Now, even in this story, you can see the movement, the story, should have ended with the crucifixion. And the original tale we have from Mark basically does. You know, it has an empty tomb, but kind of weird. So Christianity should have taken the road of previous apocalyptic messianic movements and died with its founder and leader. But it didn't. The interesting question is, why not? Well, the Orthodox answer, and the answer we're used to hearing, is that there was physically, historically, a manifestation of Christ as a resurrected being, that if you had a camcorder sitting there, you could have gotten a good image of it. But this isn't the only possible view. There's a lot of uncertainty, both in the Gospels and in the letters of Paul, really, as to the nature of this being that appeared to Mary Magdalene. Whether it is a physical being or not appears to be a later argument that gets put into the Gospels. And Paul makes a distinction between this heavenly body and this real body, and tries to do some sort of a shell game with what's really going on. But this is the moment Christianity began. Before that, it was teaching of Christ, teaching of Jesus, this Jesus movement. It is with Mary Magdalene and her understanding that death was not the end of this, her experience, that carries Christianity forward. At this point in all of the Gospel, basically the disciples have run away, they've scattered, and haven't really shown themselves to be all that reliable to begin with, for the most part. And it's Mary Magdalene who basically gathers them back together, who becomes the center of this new movement. Now, I had gone through that entire understanding of the canonical Gospels and pegged Mary Magdalene as basically the founder of Christianity, the first Christian, the first apostle. And then I went back and read the Gospel of Mary. The Gospel of Mary has a very interesting structure. In it, there is a beginning passage. It's also fragmentary, by the way. So we don't have the very beginning. But in the beginning that we have, there is a dialogue between Jesus and the disciples, and he's teaching them. He then goes off, leaves them, and then there's, you know, like a scene change, chapter change, and the disciples are then grieving at the loss. This is after the crucifixion. and they're wondering what to do. And basically Mary becomes the one who says, the Lord has taught us how to be the true sons, the true children of humanity, and we must not lose heart. And Peter asks Mary, Peter says to Mary, Sister, we know that the Savior loved you more than all other women. Tell us the words of the Savior that you remember, the things which you know that we don't, because we haven't heard them. Mary responded, I will teach you about what is hidden from you. And she began to speak these words to them. She said, I saw the Lord in a vision, and I said to him, Lord, I saw you today in a vision. He answered me, How wonderful you are for not wavering at seeing me, for where the mind is, there is the treasure. In this account, she's speaking of something that happened perhaps before crucifixion. It's where she saw Christ in the vision. And she then recounts her dialogue with the Savior about this vision and what it meant. So this is kind of the flashback. And then this is her telling what the Savior taught her, what she learned. And one of the interesting things is that the only thing indicating that the dialogue she has after she says, I saw the Lord in the vision, is just this one little line where she says, Lord, today I saw you in the vision. But that doesn't indicate that wasn't a visionary experience either. Now, if you look at the Gospel of Mary the way Standard Orthodox does, that this is just a forgery, a bunch of stuff made up, thrown in to the mouths of apostles and so forth, well, there's a good question as to why you have this visionary experience. And you could have put to the mouth of Christ at the beginning of the Gospel, many teachings you wanted to, or you could have not mentioned this vision and been a bit more credible, just said that this was a dialogue I had with Xavier. But there's this, and this is odd. And this seems to tie into that canonical account and into other indications that we have. Stop and remind you to interrupt me. No interruptions.
If you were to construct this happens as a story, then could you conceive this metaphor of a masculine theologians coming to some enlightenment and testing that this female, this feminine figure is going to enlighten men?
It's possible. There are a lot of ways of looking at sort of the witness of Mary and the women at the tomb. None of them particularly sort of positive. So as far as most scholars are concerned, it seems to go back to some real historical root. There was something really important about what happened there and about Mary of Magdalene, at least in most accounts. So it might be viewed as being, like a projection thing, but I don't know. There doesn't seem to be any indicator in the text or in the tradition for that to work. We will get to another way of looking at that here in just a bit. Where Mary of Magdalene appears in the Gospel of Philip, appears in the famous quote that is appears in the Da Vinci Code, that Jesus loved her more than all the other disciples, used to kiss her on the mouth often. And she also appears in other quotes, one in which it says that Sophia is the mother of the angels, Sophia whom they call barren is the mother of the angels, and the companion of the Lord was Mary Magdalene, whom they called his consort.
It's also said in the Da Vinci Code that the word companion literally, maybe this is all fiction, word companion literally meant spouse.
That is part of the fiction, actually. The Gospel of Philip is written in Coptic that we have. It was translated from Greek into Coptic. And that word is actually left as a loan word from Greek. And I forget what it is exactly, but it means more of a companion or associate than like a spouse or a romantic engagement of some kind. So that is part of the fiction. But being, you know, a close companion, being, you know, mother, sister, companion, does give one kind of this interesting connection. And so what one thinks of in these previous stories is the Eros Kamos, the sacred union, and the divine birth from that sacred union. And essentially I see this as being an echo of the existing story, which is the story of the birth of Christ, which appears in the Gospels as well. That we have our two different forces coming together externally to create some new thing. However, in the Gospel of Philip, there's also a passage that says that the perfect reproduce themselves through a kiss. And in the Gospel of Thomas, there's a passage where the Lord asks the disciples to say who I am. Thomas responds, I can in no way say who you are. And Jesus says, I'm no longer your master, for you have drunk from the burbling spring which I have poured forth. And there's a long tradition of this kiss, which we only get in a very watered-down form as the kiss of peace. And this was a symbol of spirit. In our language, English, spirit usually isn't directly related to breath, but in the ancient languages, was. We only have like respiration to think of. To convey something spiritually, you can convey it through the breath, convey it through the lips, also to convey it through the word, through the logos. And so this points to another means of conveyance, of transformation, of procreation, if you will, that isn't coming together externally, but is it coming together internally? We have from the Gospel of Thomas, this is one of the most famous passages from the Nag Hammadi library. When you make the two into one, and you make the inner like the outer, and the outer like the inner, and the upper like the lower, when you make the male and female into a single one, so that the male will not be male, nor the female female, when you make eyes in the place of an eye, a hand in the place of a hand, a foot in the place of a foot, an image in the place of an image, then will you enter the kingdom. There is also another short passage that says, the solitary one shall enter the bridal chamber. So what this points us to are different levels which we can understand these symbols. It doesn't remove the other ways of looking at them, but there are deeper ways. This seems to be what particularly the Gnostics were talking about, that there are things to be united within us. And the word that is used for this mystery is the bridal chamber. This appears in many Gnostic texts, particularly in Philip and Thomas. This is seen as being the highest mystery. It's the last one listed in the famous list in the Gospel of Philip. There is a Eucharist, redemption, and a bridal chamber. What seems to be evoked to some extent with the power that the story of a marriage between Christ and Mary Magdalene has is that it resonates with this truth, that our symbols aren't so much historical, but living within us. And that to see this as a marriage isn't to see it as a marriage in some distant time and place, but really a marriage of external beings or historical characters, but of a mystery that points us back to that transformative part of the story that occurs near the end, that the rest of the story is building up to. And in that list of mysteries, where it appears at the end, you see that this is the end, the completion of a process. There are four other stages, at least, that one goes through to get to where one can enter into that process. Sure, somebody wants to grow. Come on.
Is this in correlation with being ethereal on a different level?
Essentially, that's what it is. It's an ancient touching upon that idea that occurs also in Hermetic literature and occurs as a mythic idea in the Eros Kamos, so forth before. It's really put as an internal idea perhaps for the first time, in this tradition, at least in the West. So this is the internal hieroskamos, the taking the process of the undifferentiated mass of who we are, taking it through that process of separation, analysis, understanding, consciousness, and recombining it into something more. And really, I think what the Gnostics were talking about wasn't even the psychological aspect of these things. They were pointing even deeper, that there was nuncio that is this bridal chamber mystery, isn't merely human conjunction. There's a conjunction between human and divine. There is mixing between those two opposites and the transformation and the new transcendent thing from that. So if you look at the other things, I mean, essentially, most of them are what we're familiar with that are listed in the Gospel of Philip. Baptism, chrism, Eucharist. Then there is redemption, or the freeing, or the... It really is more like ransoming in the sense of redeeming a Coke bottle or something, redeemed this for 5 cents in Connecticut or whatever. And it really is this being freed from an obligation or from a burden or from a debt. And then there is this bridal chamber mystery that is mentioned. And to see it as being, as so many have, as being this physical act, why is it included in this list of mystery? Why is it there? Seems to really be a very spiritual act and a divine act, a human act, all at the same time. Okay.
Also,
Yes, and this is also, in some ways, a echoing of another part of the story, which is the virgin birth, right? Being born of God and human, being this odd mixing of things.
As the unregenerate birth, and as Mary is redeemed from her past and turns to her, what is the birth of the past? So that also is symbolic of birth, which is also an unregenerate state in the inside.
Go ahead.
I was just going to mention that it just occurred to me after I saw this. I read the book, but it appears to me that this whole loss of the divine feminine is man's womb envy idea. And instead of, like, they're going to take birth away from women and make it this virgin birth and recapture it, make it a patriarchal spiritual system that doesn't include women. And that just made so much sense to me. It makes me understand it a better way. I'm really glad I read it. I saw the Da Vinci Code. Changed my idea completely about what it's all about. And I think that this whole dogma that the sacred feminine, that it'll never work without it.
Yeah.
And that's where this whole virgin birth comes from, recapturing the male as woman in me, and now feeling good about it. We don't have to go back, we don't have an end, a home, because that's like the miracle of life. Man wants it.
There is a lot of things that are deeply mixed into all these stories, and biology is one of the things that is intrinsically mixed in human nature.
That's what that means, the two positive energies becoming one. Without the feminine, which is obviously what the Christian Church has done, and it makes perfect sense. I'm so glad
that. Well, feminine is one aspect of it, but there it is definitely missing a huge chunk. But to frame it merely as the feminine, I think, is to miss a lot of things.
So,
but yeah, there's certainly something missing. But in the way, if you look at what went into that cultural state wherein these stories occurred, you have essentially our different reproductive issues and strategies and costs and cultural ways to control these things. You look at human reproduction, female obviously puts in a lot more work to produce a child. And if you have a very cynical eye, which I do sometimes, you can see human culture as being a way of trying to readdress this balance, as being a way of readdressing from this biological imbalance to having there be a cultural imbalance in the other direction, so that men then have the control over the reproduction, whereas in the natural state, clear of all these cultural things and force and everything, then the female has a clear advantage, and should, because it's the most energy, resources, time into reproduction. And so all of that goes into the cultural background and really becomes a part of the story of Mary Magdalene. It's how she is seen as being wife and mother of harlot. That the culture is topsy-turvy because it's built upon biology, which is topsy-turvy, but we can't then put religion on top of that, which is topsy-turvy, and expect things to go well after that. We need to sort of dig back down to the foundation and clear away a lot of this rubbish. See what is before our face, as the Gospel of Thomas tells us to do. And that if we are open to that, we see that God is not a small thing, not an idea. It's not one form. That except when being used in propaganda, it's more of a mystical experience. That even in the Old Testament, these things, there is a mystical aspect of God. There is God as mother. There is an openness to the real experience of the divine. The real experience of the divine isn't going to be what you think it is going to be. It's going to be what it is, which is fuller, bigger, vaster than us. It's going to include everything we're aware of and more.
Is it a Gnostic thing to keep it internal? I think AG should actually be an internal experience.
Well, it seems to be what they were talking about in these texts, but this is, you know, talking about religious texts and religious functions and rituals. So this isn't the whole of life. Well, I mean, say that it is internal isn't to say anything about anything else. That there is this internal, deep, divine, spiritual union says nothing about any, you know, social, psychological, relationship, or whatever, at all. You know, it doesn't mean that you only have to have an internal experience, but it does say that's where we're pointing to. Well, he takes the quotes that refer to the bridal chamber and turn them into a very physical and historical thing. But the quotes really seem to refer to a very present, real, spiritual experience we can attain in this world. And so, to me, he's playing a game where he's wanting to tell a particular story. I mean, we always have to keep in mind that he's not giving us a theological treatise. He's going with the aim, with the direction, and he's using what helps him along the way. So he's using these things to help him tell the story about the bloodline. There being an internal nuncio, an internal bridal chamber, doesn't say anything about there being a bloodline or not. It just says that what was interesting to the Gnostics, and what I think much more interesting to us, is that internal aspect, because we can get that. We can't marry Jesus. Unless, I guess, if you're a nun, you know, do so symbolically or something. But we can have this union with the divine within ourselves, deep experience. And that really transforms us in a way that no external thing can. I mean, people seek these things externally in relationships, but you don't find your wholeness in a relationship. You find lots of other things, but your psychological wholeness isn't there. And so you have to realize that although these symbols of a marriage and so forth can play an active role in seeking our own communio, they're seeing them as out there isn't doing anything for us, I don't think. Okay. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Whoever. Go ahead.
Well,
And we also talk about these several aspects about it taking any kind of presence, taking anything away from the higher understanding or primal understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I say, it has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Permanently, yeah, as it goes so low. So the whole idea of the incarnation is the invisible embodiment of spiritual principles.
But if you look at why people are attracted, why it's grabbing them, I don't think it's this historical thing. You know, history isn't that appealing to most people. It isn't going to be a multi-million dollar bestseller or whatever. And it's that psychological appeal that leads to, kind of ties into this inner symbol, I think, that's why it's resonating. And if we just leave it at the physical level, then I think we're missing why it's important. Yeah, well, we see reflected in history these internal things, definitely. But it, again, becomes kind of this incarnational immanentness. And it isn't this conjunctio of opposites on a horizontal plane, but it becomes more of a vertical one, the divine versus the human, the spiritual versus the material. So you do have it, but it's of a different nature. And you do also have the divine feminine, but with a fairly limited scope. You know, you have a lot of Marianic praise and adoration and so forth through, you know, most of the centuries. Where it basically cuts off is with Protestantism, where they decide that, you know, this is going overboard. This is basically not monotheism if you're praising Mary this much, right? This is idolatry of Mary. This is Mary as a goddess. And so they cut out Mary. But there's this presence there that has to come in, right? Because human spiritual experience is there. So if there is absolutely nothing there, something will occur. And if there's something there, then you can kind of monkey with it a little bit officially and so forth, but it will always occur. So these connections are always there, they're just maybe there in a different way. And the way in which I think we need to look at these things, which I put on the slide, is to look at them as being both, this coming together on the horizontal and on the vertical, is to see all these connections together, and this is the union. But this is a bridal chamber.
I was wondering about the scripture. It talks a lot of a passage where it says, you know, Jesus said that God is the bridegroom and we are the bride. And does this relate to this bridal chamber at all?
Yeah, there is.
Weddings.
Yeah, there seems to be a common theme and thread through even the canonical gospels. And so it does seem to point to an historical something. But the way that the story is told about that, you know, that we've gotten to is that, you know, the bride becomes the church or, you know, something abstract. Basically afraid of having Jesus having physically married anybody. And so they have to make it very theological and abstract in the interpretation.
Like what you just said, it sounded like you said to me, it would be too confusing for people to think of Jesus and Mary
being
married, and so they changed.
Well, now I think as theology progressed, they definitely had to keep them apart. But if we look at the very beginnings of things, the evidence really isn't there that there was any relationship. You know, we're making some pretty big assumptions that, to me, indicate that we're telling a different story rather than looking at what's there. The assumptions we're making are that they were of reasonable age. We have no reason to think that that's the case. In fact, her being wealthy probably indicates that she was more likely an older woman, a widow.
To be somewhat attractive, she
well, that's the other way, but there's no indication in the canonical things that she was a prostitute. That comes in later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they officially.
Shh,
don't tell anyone. This is the 10th century, I think.
In the dark of the Gnostic priesthood, you're a Gnostic priest.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
That's a bit longer than we got time for it. But the Gnostic tradition is that tradition that Orthodoxy defined itself in opposition to and basically left behind. It was declared the first heresy. And over time, became suppressed, and there were different movements and flourishings at different points in time in history. And some texts have been discovered recently, and some a bit earlier, that give us some indication of, you know, the stories that they told and some of the practices that they followed. But most of the information that we had up until the 20th century was the writings of the heresiologists, these proto-Orthodox writers writing against the Gnostics, they declaring them heretics and seeing why they shouldn't be believed and why they're dangerous and so forth. And so there's a lot of confusion if you look out the world as to what the term means. There's people who take their meaning from the heresiological writings, the anti-Gnostic writings, and others who take their meaning from the historical texts, and others who just make up stuff. Okay.
So it kind of shows the science idea.
Yeah, well, essentially that's what we have, is she becomes this field of projection because there's so little told about her that we tell stories about her as human beings over time. And those tell more about us than they do about her.
But the Gnostic view is more ambiguous as to her role in the
world. Well, there aren't really beliefs. There aren't really important beliefs, I guess, in Gnostics. It's more about the gnosis, which is experience or recognition. So it's more of a mystical bend, but a mysticism that encompasses doctrine as well. So you don't have doctrine as a barrier to what you experience either, if that makes sense. It's sort of a Cliff Notes version. But it is this tradition that really appears to be going back to the beginnings, because it is one which honors this early visionary woman that is the beginning of Christianity, and sees this as being the living Christ. Gnostic scriptures will often talk about the living Jesus or the living Christ. What they're talking about is this experience post-crucifixion. And it isn't an experience that is a physical presence. They're more open to it being a visionary or an inner experience, and that still being a real experience. The difference between a Gnostic point of view is that internal subjective things still need to be real, whereas in the proto-Orthodox, more external point of view, it wouldn't be real if there wasn't a physical body standing there talking to you. So it looks at this as an internal transformational experience. And the way to achieving that is through gnosis, which is that understanding or knowledge that comes from an experience of the divine, direct experience. It doesn't come from an intellectual understanding or a reading of the story. It really is taking that different take from having like a written text or something, from going to a formalization we have of theology and a doctrine. Instead, the Gnostic tries to go back to that original experience and experience it again for themselves. And the text hasn't had its meaning, it hasn't really been understood until the person reading it has experienced it in that deeper way, in the way that touches the experience of the person who wrote it. So it really is more of this different focus, kind of looking in different directions in some ways. But those aren't exclusive. They always both include the other a little bit.
Hit yourself in the way, so you can feel more like Jesus Christ. Hit yourself like that.
What's that?
Gnostic. I mean, you just have experience for yourself. Is that like the whipping of the self?
No. No, that's very physical. Knowledge from experience, or transformation from experience. So gnosis isn't just raw experience. Gnosis is something that comes from experience. And in many languages, there's a distinction between two different types of knowledge. One of them is kind of this factual abstract knowledge you can get from books. The other is recognition or being familiar with directly. So that to be a guide across a landscape, you would have gnosis of that landscape. Or to be able to recognize someone, you would have gnosis of them. Whereas if you'd read an account of them or their dossier or something and had a picture, you might not recognize somebody. You might have all this information on them and you wouldn't know them because you don't have any gnosis of them. So it's that kind of knowledge. It's not raw experience or having the physical experience, but it's that transformative experience. So it doesn't see the value of the story of Christ as being this physical suffering or this physical death. It focuses on the teachings. And the teachings point to this inner transformation. When you make the two one, you make the inner like the outer. So it is really kind of Christianity for internal use as opposed to for external use. And the split really deepened and occurred when Christianity essentially became more of an imperial form and conjoined with politics, you know, with the Emperor Constantine and so forth. And that's when it needed to take more of this external orthodox form, and that's when the orthodox view, proto-orthodox view, won out. And there was one story, one way to understanding things. All these things were historical, they were physical, they happened once back there. We'll tell you what they mean, you don't go looking for it. Whereas Gnostics were, of course, much more wild, crazy, unpredictable, and wouldn't make a good imperial religion because you would have to go seek the meaning of these things for yourselves, try to achieve that internal transformation. Whereas redemption and salvation aren't these abstract terms, theological terms, that you never experience, you never have any clue whether you have or haven't received them. Where there are these internal processes where you go through a process of experiencing things, transforming things, bringing these two together in different ways, and coming up to that transcendent other multiple times. And that's a process that we see mirrored in other spiritual paths. We see it in Buddhism and elsewhere, that there is the individual is the focus. And the individual without religion is important, but the religion without individual is meaningless. You have to have an individual understanding it, practicing it, following it. It's a path. If somebody doesn't follow it, it doesn't mean anything. So it's really a different approach that makes sense.
That we have that paradigm. It makes me think that they're all the same.
Well, in a sense, and that is a sense in which the Hermetic texts were understood, is that the figure Hermes was not understood as being an external figure, but was a figure that essentially someone would embody if they'd gotten through this transformed state. And so there is also a tradition of putting on Christ, becoming like Christ. And essentially, you know, they had it, that other one,
this one's talking about
the process doesn't merely be this cyclical thing, but in a way you are becoming transformed, becoming more Christ-like, becoming this different being, and that can then transform others. And so, having gone through this psycho-spiritual experience, having combined different aspects in this transformative process, that echoes, mirrors the cyclical process of these sacred stories. One becomes like the characters in the story. One carries them forward. One embodies those elements. And so when Mary sees Christ after the crucifixion. She is the Christ bearer. She is the one who brings Christ to the disciples. And that is a very Gnostic idea, because Gnostics always had a sense of the Christ within. This was an immediate personal experience. And really, that part seems to point to, as many others do, very early Gnostic understandings of Christianity that then these other stories and other frames and forms get put on top of, become filters of. This takes us to the title, which is The Spiral Sacred Quest. In the book, in the film, the main character was on a grail quest. He tries to seek on the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail of all Holy Grail quests. And he finds it, the place where he began. He ends up having gone through different layers, different cycles, back where he was, the loop. But what is different is he has gnosis now. He knows what's there. Or he had some intimation. There's a subplot in the book that doesn't appear in the film about him having uncovered this, at least clues to the resting place of the bones of Mary Magdalene and about to publish them in his book. So he had some episteme, had some intellectual knowledge, some idea about these things. And the movie does a pretty good job of showing him go through a process where he doesn't believe these things to begin with. He has an understanding of them. He can lecture about them. He can write books about them. But he doesn't think that these things exist that he's writing about. Whereas as he goes through this process of experiencing and uncovering, he gains that gnosis of what is truly there, the real meaning of these things. They aren't ideas. And where this leads him, simply back to the beginning. Nothing in the external world has changed, but he has changed. He's gone from an intellectual seeker of the Grail to someone who has felt they've found the Grail. They have found something that connects them to this story. When the Grail appears in literature and in legend, seems to indicate that transformative element that a group might have or that we might seek and yearn for. You're seeking to have this unitive experience, this bridal chamber experience. And the groups that are traditionally ascribed as defenders and protectors of the Grail are the Knights Templar and the Cathars. Both of these were known to have esoteric practices, inner sacramental practices. Don't know what these were, but they had them.
Do you think that the story may be true as far as their depiction of the Knights Templar? Or did they take their own creative license there?
Yeah. Basically almost all the details in the Da Vinci Code book and film are incorrect. But the underlying stories have truth to them.
All these secret societies like the Illuminati and the Knights Templar, the Masons, all have this oral tradition that dates all the way back to the beginning of time. And it's very, it'd be arrogant to think that we knew what they were really about.
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot about them because they're secret. Just like we don't know a whole lot about the ancient mystery religions because they were secret. But much like the ancient mystery religions where people went through that process and then reported that they no longer feared death, seems to have been something in these other groups, particularly the Cathars. We know that the Cathars, Mont Segur, they negotiated a surrender, waited 2 days, and they were given the option. You can renounce your heresy and live. Well, none of them did. Not only that, many of the mercenaries that they had hired to defend them, because they could not engage in combat themselves, converted, became perfecti, received what they called the consulamentum, this final sacrament where one was prepared for death, or to become a perfecti, a being that essentially was in the world but not of it, their version of clergy. And so there was definitely something transformative that they had, that had real power, because these people felt it changed them.
Were the Knights Templar involved in the Crusades?
Yes.
Okay. You know what I'm thinking right now? I'm thinking, you know, who were the Christians to go in and slaughter all the Muslims? And did they cause 9/11 that long ago? You know, now the Pope saying that, you know, quoting text that illuminated Muhammad and the whole Muslim faith and heresy and barbarism.
Yeah, it's been called a...
Really, really.
Yeah, well, there's quite a bit of history there, but essentially the Crusades were what one historian at least has called the barbarian invasion of the Middle East, and it really seems to have been. But without them, we probably wouldn't have had the Renaissance, because we wouldn't have had the access to the texts preserved in the Arabic writings and culture and everything. So, but, you know, then they had their movement against the West to convert it by the sword, too. So, blood on everybody's hand.
Like then they talk about the burning of the women by the Vatican. There were midwives. And we know that there was a Salem witch trial, but I mean, like, way back before that, you know, during the Crusades, when they were killing women.
Well, actually, the Inquisition started as a movement against, in a crusade, really against Christians, a crusade against the Cathars. The Cathars were the beginning of the Inquisition, and they were the receivers of a Christian crusade, of armed armies just going through and basically slaughtering them. And so this began as trying to stamp out this Cathar heresy, which has been linked to Manichaean groups through the group called the Bogomils, which essentially very Gnostic in nature. And so this began as a way of suppressing this different understanding and view and story of Christianity and suppressing their transformative practices, and became then used to, you know, to have a good tool for destruction and terror. Nobody ever shelves these things and dismantles them. They just keep using them for whatever else goes along. So basically the entire mechanism of Inquisition was created for the Cathars and then continued thereafter. Basically, you can trace to the Cathars the origin of the holy orders, the orders of friars that became involved with the Inquisition, both the Dominicans and the Franciscans, as being basically mirror images of the Cathars. So a lot of this stuff you can really see occur in microcosm at points in history where all these forces swirl up again. They were always there, they were always happening, but at certain points they just kind of, the perfect storm moment or whatever happens, and you can see all the currents that went into them. And that's one of them, that to control in an orthodox sense, and to control when you become the power of the world, which in Western Europe the Pope was, basically both the secular and the sacred ruler, then you have to control these things. That leads to oppression. And there was such a movement and a flourishing of new things and new ideas and new religious movements before that, that this oppression was just a couple of centuries long before that broke. The Protestant Reformation succeeded because time changed. All these new ideas, all these new influences. It was a shifting towards the interior. And if you have a shift towards the interior, it's hard to have a very staid outward religion and feel at home in it. It doesn't do anything for your individual spiritual needs, your psychological needs. It doesn't take you on any kind of a transformative path. And so all these things really seem to revolve around what the Grail points at. And that is our connection to these things, that spark. So when we can go through a story, go through a process of understanding, get to a point where we have these opposites, we have these different views, and bring them together, there is some spark, some real electrical spark, charge goes across, and it changes us in some way. Has been hinted at, Gnostic texts, and alchemical texts that changes the world around us as well. We can become bearers of the Grail. It needn't be something distant, something physical, something historical. It needn't be an individual far removed from us. We can seek the Grail. We can obtain it. We can become people of light. The Gospel of Thomas says, person of light, there is light. When it shines, it lights the whole world. It does not shine, there is darkness. And this is what I think is at the core of the interest in the Da Vinci Code and the furor surrounding it like a storm. That the eye of the storm is this truth we all know. We've always known it. And when we hear any echo of it, it resonates within us because we know it. And it is that truth we must follow. Seek for ourselves the ground. Seek a divine union, a union of opposites. Transformation of ourselves that changes us, makes us agents of transformation in the world. It doesn't all happen at once. It is a spiral process. We will come to these things again and again. There is a center, the spiral. As long as we are moving towards that, we are on our path. We are worthy seekers of the Grail. Last comments? One of the most beautiful Gnostic texts, the Hymn of the Pearl, there is an individual sort of lost, forgetting what he's supposed to be doing in the world. And a letter is sent to him in the form of an eagle. When it comes, it basically reads itself. But the way the individual knows it's true, because it was already written on his heart, that Gnosis isn't merely finding out things, but it's a knowledge, not that you have, it's knowledge that you are. It's knowledge that changes you through obtaining it. But in the most important way, what it changes you to is to you who you truly are. You are in your deepest core. It brings that out. In many different ways, framing these things in spiritual paths and traditions. But that is what we seek. I guess we're out of time. Well, thank you all for coming. Hopefully it was useful.
I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. Please send your questions, comments, or suggestions to RevTroy@gnosis.org. Thank you.
So when you see how my horse broken, pick him up and carry him. And when you see a woman who's broken,
for information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org.
That's GNOSIS.org.
Wake up.